This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. My guest this episode, David Crosby. Okay, so a slight change of plans. The interview I promised with David Brewis of Field Music is coming next week, alongside another awesome guest. But this is kind of a bonus episode. I got a chance to interview David Crosby, and I wanted to get the interview out there as soon as possible. There's a new 50th anniversary box set of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's masterpiece, Deja Vu, out in May. It's a fantastic set. You get an all-analogue version of the original album on vinyl, which sounds amazing, and four CDs. The original album, a disc of demos, which has got some beautiful stuff. There's a disc of alternate versions, including an intense, raw 10-minute version of Almost Cut My Hair, and a disc of outtakes, which just hits home how much material they had at this time. There's liner notes from Cameron Crowe and loads of photographs. I'm really digging this set. So of course I wanted to get Crosby's perspective on it. It was a turbulent time for the band on a personal and an interpersonal level. Crosby had been dating Joni Mitchell. Bass split and she went out with Graham Nash. Crosby fell in love with a girl named Christine Turner, who died in a car accident on the way to the vet, sending Crosby into a horrible spiral. The first Crosby, Stills and Nash album had been a creative and commercial triumph, and it's fascinating to me that for the follow-up they took the brave decision to bring Neil Young into the group. Neil was making his astonishing album After the Gold Rush at the same time. It was not an instantly unanimous decision to bring Neil into the band, further adding to the tension. The resulting record has now sold 8 million copies, and it feels like a representative monument of a time and place where there was just something in the air, a serendipity that doesn't come along too often. Crosby has had quite a life. He got kicked out of the Byrds in the 60s, and Crosby, Stills and Nash are almost the archetypal band for falling out with each other. His addictions have caused him tremendous pain and problems over the years. He even spent a year in jail in the 1980s, which he credits with getting him off of hard drugs. Sadly, relations have been pretty bad between David and the other members of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young in recent years, but he's enjoying a late-life creative resurgence. Finding younger collaborators to work with has invigorated him. He's been putting out records pretty regularly, his latest being 2019's excellent Hear If You Listen, which credits his bandmates on the front cover. A bit like Deja Vu, you could say. Obviously, I was a bit excited, a bit nervous to interview Cros. He doesn't suffer fools gladly, and he stormed off of another podcast not too long ago. I thought I had 45 minutes with him, but it turned out to be just half hour, so it ends a bit abruptly and left me with a slightly unsatisfied feeling. Was I as good as I should have been? Well, see what you think. If you don't know loads about David Crosby, I think you'll find this pretty compelling. If you're a big fan, I hope you'll find something of interest in here. Please let me know on Twitter at Signals Podcast and on Instagram at Sending Signals Podcast. Also, I was very sad to hear of the death of Bay City Rollers frontman Les McKeown. You might remember that Les was a guest on the show back in 2019. And I'm going to play a little clip of that interview at the end of the episode in memory of Les. Hello.
Hello yourself.
How are you, man?
I am. My usual answer these days is elderly and confused, but I'm okay. I'm doing okay.
Do you know what? I actually had a question written down, which was, how are you today? Because I kind of knew that was your standard answer. And I thought, I'm not going to be that broad. I'm just going to go, how are you today? Because that seems that seems like a better approach. And then I've screwed it up on like the first question.
Not a problem, my friend.
How are you today?
I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. I just got back from the doctor's. You know, that's one of the things you do when you're old. You go to the doctor a lot. And it's never fun, you know, because they tell you, oh, gosh, you're falling apart. but, yeah. Oh, lovely. Great. Good to know. So I'm making it.
You must be doing something right, because you've been falling apart for decades and you're still here.
Yeah, it's all true. I am doing something right, man. I'm spending my time at home, which I really did not want to do, and I'm actually starting to enjoy it. We're doing it's improved my relationship with my kid, and it's made my wife happy and myself happy, because we get to spend time with each other in the summertime, which we've never gotten to do. I've always been gone on tour.
Yeah.
So it's good. It has a bunch of positive stuff. It's a tough readjustment to make, man. You got to understand how this all happened. I had two sources of income, right? Records and touring. And so then along comes streaming, and now I don't get paid for records anymore. And so there goes half my income, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to be a good guy. I'm trying to be brave and say, well, at least I can still play live and take care of my family and pay the rent, and everything's going to be okay. And then along comes COVID, and I can't play live anymore. So I've been forcibly retired. It was not my choice to do either, to stop. I would have liked to have worked this last summer. I had three tours planned, and I was really looking forward to them, because I think they would have been probably my last year on tour. I'm turning 80 this summer, and you don't have the stamina, you know, you don't have the strength to do it after a while, and that's where I am. I'm getting used to it, and I'm going to make the adjustment, but it's a big readjustment.
Has the past year been a creative time for you still, or has the pressure of like, oh, I've got
yeah,
this
no, I'm still writing.
Good.
I'm still writing, and James and I are have finished another record. That's 5 and 6 years, I think. And I have a record sitting there, finished, mastered, ready to go. I am talking to Michael League and Becca Stevens and Michelle Willis about doing another Lighthouse record. They want to, and we're actually writing another record. So, yeah, I'm still creating, but it's weird that, you know, I think what bothers me about the streaming thing, man, as much as anything else is, I mean, it bothers me that they're not paying me, but it really bothers me that they're making billions with a B and not paying the artists who are creating the music. And that's very disturbing to me. There's no way I'm going to think that that's okay.
I guess there's a flip side in that, I mean, I listened to Here If You Listen, and I thought it was fantastic. And
thank you. I did too.
I kind of, I want to buy it now, but I probably wouldn't have been at that stage had I not given it a listen first, you know?
And yeah, so, that works. The problem is they don't pay me.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Everybody loves streaming who's using it, because it's very convenient, but it doesn't pay the artists. They are making a ton of money, and they could share it, but they don't.
I guess I might be an anomaly, because I'm kind of old. I'm young enough to enjoy streaming, but old enough to still want the physical thing of albums I love. So
yeah, I switched over. I got rid of all my CDs and stuff, and I wish I had them back now.
Right. Can I ask about making an album like Here If You Listen? Because that project in particular, you put four names on the cover. You know, you've got all four names there. Yours is bigger. But
well, I can tell you how it happened. What happened is this. I went and worked with Michael League on a benefit record, and I liked him a tremendous amount. You know who he is, right?
Is this a guy from Snarky Puppy? Am I getting confused?
That's him, yeah.
Right,
he's
okay.
He's the band leader and bass player and composer, most importantly, for Snarky Puppy.
Right.
And I just really liked him tremendously. He's a really, really wonderful multi-instrumental, great player, great thinker, great writer. He's even a good singer. He's good at just about everything, and I really liked him a lot. So I said, let's make a record. Come and produce a record for me. So he came to my house, and we sat down, and we wrote three of the songs on that record in the first 2 days, just bang, one right after another. And I said, oh boy, I found another great vein of gold. And he and I made that record pretty much by ourselves, just the two of us. We played everything, sang everything, and towards the end of it, we needed some other vocals. So he said, let's use Beck and Michelle. And I said, okay, are they good people? And he said, they're two of the best people I know. And so we started working with them, and they were great. And there was a definite chemistry between the four of us. So the next time I said to them, listen, I'd like to do another record. I'd like to do a record of the four of us. And I'd like all four of us to write it, and all four of us to sing it, and all four of us be the artist. And they said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I am very sure. There's a chemistry here, and I intend to pursue it because it's good. And so then we got together and wrote Here If You Listen together. And then we recorded it together. And it's a wonderful chemistry, man. Michael is a fantastic musician, and Becca and Michelle are both immensely talented singer-songwriters. If anything, they're better than me. They're really good. And we're thinking about doing yet another one, even though we're not getting paid for it.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I was shocked how good it was. You know.
Thank you, man.
What was the division of the creative input? Would you say it ended up being about 25% each?
You know, it varies from song to song. On one song, you know, it'll be mostly one person, and another song will be mostly another person. Like when you get Vagrants of Venice is 90% me and Becca. We wrote it, the two of us.
Yeah.
But what Michelle and Michael did to it in the recording process and the mixing process is almost as important as how we wrote it. So, you know, yes, we get the publishing credit, but everything on there is a result of four people. Everything on there is a result of that chemistry. And it's a definite chemistry. And they want to do it again. I want to do it again. It's a little difficult. Michael's moved to Spain. And I don't really want to get on a commercial airliner right now. So yeah. I don't know how we're going to do that, but I think we're going to try.
The lyric that grabs you by the throat on that album is On Your Own Ride.
Thank you, man.
I've been thinking about dying and how to do it well.
That's me and Bill Lawrence. And, you know, he's one of the keyboard players with Snarky Puppy. And it's our best song. I really like what he did. He wrote the music, and it's really brilliantly right for the lyrics. And it's a very honest song.
Is that your lyric?
Yeah, it's my lyric. I wrote it for my son, Django.
What does dying well look like for you?
It's a tough thing. You want to not just roll over and put your paws in the air. You know that you're going to die. And it's not really, you know, what everybody gets obsessed with is how long do they have. And that's not really, you know, something you're going to be able to nail down. And it's not the most important factor. The most important thing is how you spend the time that you have. If you have 2 weeks or 10 years, you can't really do much about changing that. But you can define the thing by how you live each day. So knowing that you have a limited amount of time sort of clears the deck for you. You sort of say, okay, I'm only going to do stuff that's really important to me and that really makes me happy. And that's, I should have done it sooner.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if you've got 10 years left and you waste them, that's not more valuable than having a perfect 2 weeks, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Precisely. That's my point. Yeah.
I got sent the new Deja Vu box set a few weeks back, which is fantastic. You know, sometimes these sort of expanded editions, you get them and you think it's nice, but you realize you're probably not going to listen to the extra stuff that much. But the quality control on this set is fantastic, and yeah, it's amazing really. How involved do you get in putting together something like this, or do you just sort of sign off on it?
It depends on which one of us you are. Graham loves to put these kinds of things together.
Yeah.
He's been the one who's, you know, organized the box sets before. I don't know how much input he had on this one, but I assume that he was the one who picked stuff. I just said, okay, go ahead. And I'm happy they did it, and I think they did a good job. Yeah. And I have a copy, and I think it looks good and feels good. So I'm okay with it. I'm fine with it.
Have you listened to it?
Yeah. One time through, just to make sure it was good.
And what did you think?
I think, you know, it's a very interesting experience, man. You're so set, having listened to Deja Vu hundreds of times, right? You're so set on how that goes that the other stuff is a little jarring to me. But I think it's all good stuff, so I'm fine with it.
Did anything surprise you?
Yeah, that track of Stevens that we didn't use. I think it's quite good.
The version of Laughing on there is really excellent, I thought.
Thank you, man. It's a good song. You know I wrote it to George, right?
Oh, did you?
You don't know that story? Okay, so I'll tell you the story. This is the short version.
All right.
When we went to England, the Birds, when we went to England the first time, I had just been turned on to Ravi Shankar. And I had his record in my suitcase, and I gave it to George Harrison. That had repercussions.
Yeah.
He liked it. He liked it, and that led him to Indian music. And then that led him to India, which led him, while he was in India, to a guru, a teacher. And he was talking to me later, and he said, I really like this guy, and I think he's kind of got a glimpse of what's really going on. And I said, I wanted to say, take it with a grain of salt, because I'm very skeptical about anybody who tells you they got God's address and phone number right.
Yeah.
I don't believe him. So I wanted to tell him, you know, well, okay, maybe the guy's got some truth, but don't take it with a grain of salt. Be skeptical. I wanted to say that. It's George. I couldn't do it. I was chicken. Okay. That's the truth. I was so in awe of the guy, and I wanted so badly to be his friend, but I didn't want to offend him, so I didn't say it. So I wrote that song instead.
Right.
That song is me saying, I understand you've run into somebody that sounds like they know the truth and what's really going on, but be patient about it and wait and see, because the only person that I've ever thought really was bathed in the truth with a child laughing in the sun. And I don't even know if George heard it.
Right.
But that's who I wrote it to.
So the thing I really want to ask about Deja Vu is, I guess it's kind of difficult, and you can tell me to shut up, but...
Shut up!
Yeah, that's it. It's weird because, you know, for someone like me, you know, you are part of this rock and roll mythology, you know, and so the stories around how albums get made, they're so detached from your own life. You know, you're some guy that I'm never going to talk to out in California who made a record 50 years ago, and there's these stories around it, and so you naturally have stuff you want to, you know, stuff you think about, and then actually getting to talk to you and realizing that for you this is real. You know, and these are real people, and this was really your life. And I guess knowing what happened to Christine when you made this album, I just wonder how, if you can look at this album and not shudder, you know, because it just must feel like monument to the worst time of your life.
It's a different thing. It's a different thing. It was an enormous amount of pain, because I did love the girl. It was shocking, you know, seeing her there dead, was hard for me, really hard. I cried a lot. Truthfully, man, the music saved my life.
Right.
The music that we were making, we were in the middle of making Deja Vu, and it was very tough for me. I would wind up sitting on the floor of the studio crying.
Yeah.
But we did it, and we made really good music. And that kept me going. And then I stayed in the studio because I didn't have anywhere else to go that I could handle. It was the only place I felt safe. And that's when I made If I Could Only Remember My Name. So I made those two records back to back in the same studio and just hid in there because when I went out in the world, I had to face what had happened and I couldn't really deal with it.
So how does the album make you feel now? Or just seeing it? Like, how do you feel?
Mostly good. You know, the songs are so good, man. You know, Carry On and Stills was just peaking. I will say for the record, Stills was the most talented guy in the group. There's no question. He was the best guitar player, writer. He was the best singer. And his stuff, his songs on that record are monumental. He was amazing. And he was very, very strong and very forward and very there and very part of the group.
I've been thinking a lot about, there's a lyric by Drive-By Truckers, which is, the secret to a happy ending is knowing when to roll the credits.
Yeah.
And like, when you look at the CSN story, you know, there's these moments of redemption when everything, you know, just against all odds, things are going well. You know, I remember seeing you at Hyde Park supporting Paul McCartney and you played a storming set. It was wicked, you know, and there are these moments where if the film about CSN finished there, you'd be like, wow, that's a redemptive story, you know, and life sort of carries on and then more stuff goes down. And it's hard from when you haven't lived through it, you know, and you're looking at it again through this prism of like rock mythology, you just can't help but think, you're all still alive. There's still this chance that there could be this happy ending to the story. Do you think about that?
I know it's not possible.
Surely is why you're still all here. It might be possible.
No.
Okay.
You want to know why? That's your question.
Do I want to know why? I mean, I think, is there anything you can say that hasn't been well documented? Because that's the thing, what I don't want to do is hack you off by asking you about stuff that you get bored of being asked, and that is...
And don't worry about it. Here's the story, man. And I invite you to, when you write this, to write it as kindly as you can.
Well, this is a podcast, so...
So here's the story. Stills is in CSNY, Stills is the absolute center of the deal. And his hearing is gone.
Right.
And that means he can't sing in pitch, because you can't, you know, that's a feedback mechanism. You have to be able to hear to be able to do it. And so we're done. That's over. He's the main guy. He's our best singer, and he can't do it. And it's done. There will never be any more CSNY Live ever.
I think it's sad for you as people. Like, yeah, if you can't.
Well, you know, I can't speak to that. I'm not mad at anybody. Two of them are mad at me, and I don't really care. The important part is the music, and I think, you know, we deserve credit for what we did. I think we did a fantastic job. I think CSNY was a great band. I think it should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on its own because it's completely different than CSN. I think that I'm proud of it, but it was then, and it is done, and it will not ever happen again.
All right, this is my final question on this subject, all right? What happens if you phone them and just try and fix it. What happens in that scenario?
Still I can't phone because he can't hear.
Right.
And Neil and Stephen don't want to talk to me, so I wouldn't bother. So there you go.
Okay.
Neil and Graham.
In the documentary, I got this sense that you have this incredible kind of feeling of almost, it almost comes across as like survivor's guilt. You almost expressed like you weren't sure why you were still here and that so many people had gone and you were still here.
Yeah, but that has occurred to me. I've lost a lot of friends, you know, Hendrix and Cass and Janice and like tons of people that I really loved. And I am not so much guilty. It's not survival guilt, really. It's surprise. I'm kind of amazed that I made it through because I got to remember, man, I was a junkie and junkies die. That's what they do. And I did a year in prison in freaking Texas. And that's pretty hard to survive, too. I'm kind of amazed I'm here. Yes, I am. I turn around and look at what I've been through, and I'm definitely pleasantly surprised. I'm happy about it.
Me too.
But I am a little surprised because so many other people went down.
Yeah. You've been incredibly, like, honest about just struggling with your own temper and things, and I wondered if you developed like techniques that have helped you.
Yeah, sort of. Mainly, temper is like my biggest mistake, and so I work at it all the time. I've worked at it a lot of different ways. I've worked at it with, you know, counseling with people. I've worked at it with trying to just keep learning how to not set the trigger off in the first place. I'm happy with it. I'm happy with how I'm dealing with it. I'm trying my level best to be a decent human being, which is, you know, what I'm asking of myself and how I judge other people.
Yeah.
I don't expect people to be perfect. I expect them to be either trying or not trying. And I can sort of tell which is which, you know, when I watch people. And I do judge people that way all the time. If I think they're trying to be decent human beings, they're trying to make things better, then they appeal to me, and that's who I look for friends.
Yeah.
Listen, man, I've got another one right now, and it's 11:29, and I got to get off of here and call somebody else. I enjoy talking to you, though. If you have a further question that's really beating your brains up, send me a text or something and ask me, and I'll answer it for you. Okay?
Thank you so much, David. Take care, man.
All right, man.
All right, bye. Bye. If you enjoyed that, please check out the back catalogue of episodes. You can find interviews with Chris Hillman from The Byrds, Don McLean, Nils Lofgren from Crazy Horse and the E Street Band, Adam Duritz of Counting Crows, The Zombies, Mike, Tony and Steve from Genesis, Steve Howe from Yes, Lloyd Cole, the list goes on. And please subscribe to the show and leave a nice review if you can. As I mentioned earlier, it was really sad to hear the death of Bay City Rollers frontman Les McEwen, unexpectedly at the age of 65. Les came on the show back in 2019, and he was really nice company, and I wanted to play a little clip from our interview, just in memory of Les.
Over here, I do everything myself, so I book the gigs, and I try my best to route things the best I can. Depending on which venues are available on which days, I make sure that I've booked the band well in advance, so I give them a year's notice sort of thing of what I'm doing, with minor changes involved, of course, with people, you know, gigs might... actually, some people have went bankrupt. But So sometimes you have to change your plan slightly, but most of all, I work about a year, 9 months to a year ahead and book everything, all the hotels, the transport, get everybody in place so that when it comes to doing the gig, all I've got to think about is just singing and watching my itinerary that I made a year ago.
Yeah, I get the impression, though, that you like the control that brings, though.
I think I like it because I had no control when I was famous, if you know what I mean. Everything, every single little thing was controlled back in the day when I was, when we were having all our success, 74, 75, 76, that kind of thing. And I didn't like that at all because you felt, you know, you were always kind of wondering what's happening next. I don't know, because only the boss knows, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I thought one of the things that would calm me down and make me happier when I was touring and make the whole process more enjoyable would be to get control of that. It's a hassle. It's a real, you know, it really is a hassle. But I kind of get deep satisfaction from getting things right, if you know what I mean. When you want to book your holiday, and these days you don't go to a travel agent, you go online, you say, right, okay, I'm going to take that flight in the afternoon because I don't want to get up that early, and, you know, okay, I want to stay in that hotel because it's near the beach and I don't want to be walking, and I want to go to that restaurant, you know, and all these kind of things. You got your own bespoke kind of way of doing things.
Sure.
And that's what I like, and so it's just a more complicated version of booking your holiday.
Yeah. So when you were in the kind of madness of Roller Mania, because this is a show ostensibly about creativity, did being in the Bay City Rollers feel like a creative thing, or did it feel like a job? Did you feel more like an actor? How did it feel to you?
For me, it was an adventure. Although I kind of felt it was, you know, obviously a kind of manipulated situation because there was a manager there who was manipulating things. But I thought, well, that's what managers do. And we all have a part to play in this chaos. So I played my part, basically. And I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was an adventure. It was great going out and I see a smiling, screaming faces. All they wanted to do was, like, grab you. I don't know what they'd do if they got a hold of you, but, they just screamed after you and all that kind of stuff. It was a little bit annoying because, you know, no matter how big a PA system we got, the screams would always be louder. But you went in, I went out there and did my part, performed my part, and I enjoyed it because that's what I always wanted to do. And it was only later on, like these days, or in the last 30 years, that I really started to enjoy it even more because, yeah, it's great because I realised the kind of impact, even something as, I don't know what people think about boy bands, but the impact that we have had on young people's development kind of thing. It's quite deep and interesting, you know. It really is strong because they've been coming and paying like £30 a ticket to come and see me sing for the last 45 years. So I'm quite happy about that.
Thank you so much for talking. And
don't worry, anytime, you got my number.
I have. Thank you. Look after yourself, mate.
Take care.
All right, man. Bye.
And that's our show. Thanks as always to our guests whose opinions are our own. Thanks also this week to Rob Krauser and Sue Handley. I'll be back next week. Bye for now.